Welcome to Juno Afternoon on this fabulous Friday. I'm Rhonda McBride, and we'll cap off the week together with a few conversations that offer food for thought. Coming up, building bridges to Native students through language and culture. Also, there's a relationship between ice and tiny spores released from fungi. Why a researcher from the University of Alaska Southeast says it's an important relationship to understand. And some armchair bird watching ahead. Now, the forecast. Rain showers tonight with a chance of rain persisting through the weekend. Otherwise, mostly cloudy. Lows tonight in the lower 50s. Juno Afternoon. We'll be right back after National Native News.
Support for National Native News and Juno Afternoon comes from Clinkin and Haida social enterprises like Sacred Grounds Coffee, Sacred Shine Auto Detailing, and Smokehouse Catering. Learn more at www.ccthita-nsn.gov. Clinkin and Haida. Local, Indigenous, proud.
KTOO would like to take a moment to recognize that we are on Tlingit Ani, the homelands of the Tlingit people. The borough of Juneau has two clans, the Akwan and the Takwan. The place from which KTOO broadcasts today is the ancestral home of the Tlenedi, of Dog Salmon people, of the Akwan. We acknowledge those families of the Tlenedi who made use of this land and waterway for thousands of years and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations.
Hanson Gress, Ka eat with the shu yi, we kashuk a yitin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta kanakaya ha anikak gunshish.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon. Great to have you here with us as we look at one of the biggest educational success stories of Alaska, the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute's annual region-wide education conference, which teaches the teachers to look at culture as a powerful educational tool. And joining us, David Shakely Early, who is the education program manager at the Heritage Institute, and also Dr. Lisa Richardson, who has organized this event in the past. She's a professor at the University of Alaska Southeast. So thank you both for joining us. And David, I thought we'd start off with you. I know that as you get closer towards a conference, and this is starting on Thursday, August 5th, that everybody gets into warp speed mode with lots of balls to keep in the air.
That is true. It is getting very busy in the planning processes for this conference. Things are all falling in line, though. There's a lot of pieces that are moving, like you said, and a lot of balls that are up in the air. But at the end, we anticipate and really expect and hope that everything's going to run really smooth. And this is a virtual event conference that we're putting on this year. Last year, we had to have a virtual event for the first time due to COVID. So since it is a second virtual event, we are able to play off of some of the things that we've learned last year, and we don't have to start things from scratch.
Well, this is considered very innovative as far as education goes. Lisa, it must be nice to have helped to plant some of the seeds for this.
It is. It's a really powerful event, and one that we see as a genuine collaborative conversation. You know, we create the structure and the speakers and the breakout sessions, but what we love is the fact that we've built it in a way that it's so interactive that participants are able to kind of contribute to the content, that they have opportunities for discussion and engagement, and really thinking deeply about how we integrate culture, how we integrate language and effective pedagogies for all of our students.
We hear more frequently now, as the Canadian boarding school deaths are brought up, horror stories about how children were taught, not just in Canada, but in this country, here in Alaska. And it was almost as if education was seen only through one possible cultural lens. And yours didn't matter, and it didn't even matter if you could speak the language of the teachers. How far we have come.
I think there's such value in acknowledging the past, the history that we've lived through. And I think it creates a sense of urgency, right, for continuing to advocate for and build on students' strengths that historically we may not have.
So, David, are these boarding school stories a form of validation to you that you're headed in the right direction with these teacher conferences?
Absolutely, it does. And I have not personal experience of those, but my family has, you know. So my grandmother and all of her generation was a generation of these boarding schools. And for those of you out there listening, I guess, that may not be familiar, new to Alaska or somewhere else in the country, the boarding schools that we're talking of here isn't kind of like the Harry Potter boarding schools and that vision of a boarding school, learning new things and going on adventures and things like this. These boarding schools are places where Native students weren't allowed to speak their native languages. They weren't allowed to have any culture. They had to dismiss it. They had to disown it in order to be a successful person, to be a successful student, and to learn English. And English was the way to do it, and nothing else mattered. If an individual coming in, a student, were to come in and speak their language, like many, many stories that I've heard, my grandmother and other of her generation and my things like this, they'd get punished. They'd get soap put in their mouth, and they'd get locked in the closet, and they'd get hit with rulers, and they'd have their hair pulled, and they'd do really nasty things to force them to not speak their language, their native languages, and not practice their cultures and things like this. So I hear these stories. So it is very personal.
And I know that it's really important for people of Tlingit heritage to begin every conversation, especially when they're talking with people they don't know, with an introduction in their language and a land acknowledgement. So before we go forward, would you like to do that for us, David?
Sure. It's kind of a newer thing that has happened for sure with both land acknowledgements and introductions. An introduction, if you hear this from other people doing introductions, it's really you're introducing your family is really what it comes down to. You're introducing where you came from. So it's not necessarily, I have the spotlight, I have the mic, and I'm talking about myself. You're really honoring where your past came from, because without your past, without your grandparents, without your great-great-grandparents and so on, you wouldn't be here. And so it's kind of giving that homage to them for those that are a little newer to hearing these sorts of things. And Tlingit, Tlingit Kenach, Yes Yeti, Yuchatuasauk, Yes Nachatsati, Tachdain Tan, Ayachat, Hunadach, Hunakawudach, Shangu Kedi Yeti, Tachdain Tan, Hatlish Kuhas. So basically, in saying that, I'm acknowledging my father's people, the Shungu Kedi, the Thunderbird, and my grandparents and my great-great-grandparents, and also where they come from, which is Huna. It kind of brings that forward to that as well. So anyway, that's part of a general introduction, I guess, that one might hear.
So Lisa, are these some of the things that you teach your teachers at the conference?
A lot of the work that we do in kind of designing our featured speakers and how we invite those speakers to come join us in this conversation is really grounded in exactly that, right? For example, Tiffany Lee, who is joining us from the University of New Mexico, so much of her work has been advocating for the rights of linguistic and cultural sovereignty related to place. And, you know, she's Diné, she's from Navajo Nation, but so applicable to the work that we're continuing to do. And I think it will really resonate. And you'll see the threads throughout the breakout sessions, right? These teachers that have experimented with ideas are really taken up some of these concepts and they're willing to share with others. And I think that will be a really powerful way of not only creating space for educators to share effective practices with one another, but also to continue to build and refine their understandings.
You know, it's funny when you look at some school districts, especially some in some of the more remote parts of the state, where there is a real struggle to keep a constant stream of teachers. They tend to come and go year after year, and they never really understand the culture of the students. And their first strategy is to try to teach them like they've taught children in Milwaukee or Oklahoma.
There is a lot of work being done both in teacher preparation and in graduate coursework to really support pre-service and current teachers to use the community resources, to see them as resources, to seek out an understanding of place and all of the amazing brilliance that is present in the land and the elders and the community members and their students themselves. It's an ongoing conversation for sure. Like so many things that are so complex, there's no quick fix, but I would say it's a pretty strong area of focus across the state in all communities. And we also see that the more confident that the new teachers to Alaska become in engaging with their communities, the bigger gains we see in retention. Right? If you feel a lack of confidence, you're going to bail pretty quickly. If you start understanding deeply the place that you're serving, then you're more likely to stick around. And we operate from that premise. And that's a big part of this conference as well, is really thinking about what tools will build confidence in teachers.
So David, how reluctant are teachers to try teaching from another culture?
Well, I've worked with a number of teachers in the past through this program that I'm with, and also just as a teacher in the district and other things, hearing from them that if a teacher just doesn't feel comfortable with teaching the culture or incorporating the culture into their lessons, into the units, into their day, for fear of maybe if I do it wrong, I might offend somebody. Maybe if I'm missing something, I'll offend somebody. Then they just say, gosh, I don't even want to gamble. I don't want to roll the dice and even gamble because I prefer not to be looked at in a bad way or offend somebody if I try, and I just won't do it at all. And so if in that mentality, then it just doesn't get incorporated into the schools, into the classes, into the lessons. And by doing that, then it really takes something away from the student. It takes away the ability in some cases for that student to connect with the material, to connect with the teacher, to connect with the school, to connect with just going to school and being a part of school, because there's no connection that they can hang on to. It's by nature, we feel comfortable as a human being around things that we're comfortable with and familiar with. So just an example, like you go to some place that you like a restaurant even. You go there often because you like the atmosphere, you like the food. You go on vacation, you go, oh, you know what? We went to this place last time. Let's go there again. Let's invite these people because we had so much good time with them. And it's something you're familiar with and you like that. If you don't have any of those connections as an individual, you shy away and you don't find that door to open up and to say, gosh, I can relate to this. I can relate to this person. I can relate to this content and I want to be a part of it. And so it really helps, like Lisa was saying, giving teachers the confidence, allowing them to say, you know what, it's okay if you're not an expert in this material, in this culture, but even a little bit helps. A little bit helps because then that opens a door to being more comfortable, to being more receptive to the students and their needs.
So Lisa, David has talked a lot about the reluctance of teachers to engage for fear of making mistakes or offending people. So how are you through this workshop and through your presenters kind of breaking that barrier?
So we have a lot of classroom practitioners sharing what has worked in their own classrooms and being willing to do so. We know that teaching is pretty isolating. So this conference really kind of creates that space for teachers to open their doors and say, here's what I tried with my students. Here's what worked. Here's how it built on students' identities. And to David's earlier point related to kind of this lack of certainty about how to approach incorporating culture and language in the classroom, we specifically designed this year's conference to have this whole series of sessions related to engaging elders in conversation and bringing their wisdom into classroom spaces. And we hope that it's twofold, right? That there's this opportunity to have a model of how that could be, and also to have resources to seek out. So every breakout session that you attend, you have that person, right? You can contact them in the future. You can say, I want to try out something similar, and you can reach out. And I think that's what I mean when I continue to kind of refer to this as a conversation, because it is ongoing.
So who are some of the key people in this year's conversation?
As far as featured speakers, we have Tiffany Lee, who I made a reference to earlier, who's from University of New Mexico, and she'll be talking extensively about her work with Indigenous youth in the Southwest region. Candice Gala, who's from the University of British Columbia. She's a Native Hawaiian and has spoken nationally around issues of language revitalization and incorporating culture. We have Nikki Sanchez, who's a Canadian activist and scholar who will be speaking about decolonization. And she's very energizing and exciting to see. And we have a local educator from Anchorage, Ethan Pettigrew, who is a longtime Alaskan educator and has been building spaces and places that welcome students that are culturally responsive. And he has some amazing resources and examples of how to incorporate these practices into your own context. And we know we've got this wealth of amazing organizations and resources across Southeast. And that's the other thing the conference affords, right? Is this opportunity to hear across programs and to really start building some of those connections with common initiatives and common outcomes.
So how do both of you feel about this change to virtual conferences? Perhaps maybe next year it won't be the same way. You'll go back to your traditional, have everybody in a great big room and enjoy each other's company. But how is this working out?
Well, I can say that the virtual conference that we had last year more than doubled the past participants that we had in person. And there's lots of reasons for that. I mean, we have a space limitation with people coming in person and then having to travel across the state and even across the country to get in here and all these sorts of things like this. But so last year, we reached far more than we could have in person by doing this work in a virtual setting. Moving forward and thinking about future conferences, like you mentioned, maybe next year we'll be in person. We thought about already that we can't lose this virtual grasp or this virtual reach and figure out a way to tie it into an in-person conference so that we can still have this personal relationship and faces and people being in the same place, but also for those that just physically can't come here for whatever reason, we could still connect with them or find ways that they can connect to the conference and broadcast it out somehow and really have the best of both worlds, which is kind of like putting on two conferences, I guess, at the same time with some of the logistic work that go around it. But really, it's the outreach and the work that we're hoping to get out to as many people that we can. I mean, we don't want to say, gosh, we can only have so many people come in. And then after that, you can't learn this stuff. You can't engage with this. And the more outreach and the more connections we can make around the country and even in other countries, we have folks tuning in from other countries last year virtually. And even this year, we have folks from other countries tuning in and registered already now for this virtual conference.
Lisa, how does it help to have other Indigenous cultures from faraway places involved in this, even though this is a fairly local conference traditionally?
It is, and yet we know that both nationally and internationally, Indigenous populations are wrestling with many of the same ideas, many of the same challenges, and approaching it as a collective is a really empowering and powerful way to kind of go at this work. And being able to learn from all different regions what's worked, what hasn't been as effective, that is an affordance of this, not only this conference, but these conversations and the dialogue among educators and with the different featured speakers from different regions. We feel like we're really offering a space for collective problem solving, right? And collective action plans.
Collective problem solving, a safe space to do it, and maybe one that's inspiring.
The response we had last year from participants writ large was, I am on fire to do something different, right? And I have some tools I can access. And we want We want that, right? We want those actionable movements to keep gaining momentum. And like David was saying, I think that's what's a really strong benefit of the online platform, is that we have a wider reach and there's access and there's equity embedded within that.
So for people who want to sign up, teachers out there, what's the drop dead deadline for getting involved in this?
We're keeping it as open as we can. We're being very flexible, and we know that there's a lot of people that have flexible schedules that move around and things that pop up. Last year was our first virtual conference. We had people registering that morning still to get into the conference. We don't want to have a gate where we close it off and say, okay, if you don't come in by next week, you're done or whatever. That's another benefit of having a virtual conference.
So what are the key dates for this conference, David?
So this conference is, again, held virtually. It's going to be a Zoom link, and it is August 5th, 6th, and 7th, and that's the 3 days this year.
And I will be sure to put links to your conference, so if people are interested in finding out more, I'll make sure that those are on the KTOO webpage for Juno Afternoon. So just in wrapping things up, are there things you want to share with our listeners?
Well, one thing I'll mention, Lisa named off our featured speakers that we have. We have four of them. In addition to that, we have about 25 different breakout sessions during this conference with a wide range of topics. So there's lots of opportunities to get in and learn more from experts in the field and fellow colleagues and things like this that have done this in practice and said, gosh, this works. Or if you haven't tried this, try it. Or, you know, maybe you've never heard of this and try it and learn about it. So there's a huge range of things that would have an interest for a lot of people here.
One important question to ask you, though, is what's the cost for this for teachers? Do they have to dig into their own pockets?
They can dig into their own pockets, but if it's like me, if I dig into my own pocket, I'm going to find nothing in there. And so that's what we're charging this year. There's no cost for the fee. In other words, we absorb the costs of this conference so that it is available and free to those who want to come and participate. We welcome everybody. I mean, it's aimed at educators. It's aimed at administration and schools and things like this. But really, if you just have education within the physical walls of a school building, end it there, then you're missing something. And this is a bigger problem than just within the school. I mean, it's a whole community that needs to be involved. We can't end when the school bell rings at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It has to bleed into everywhere. It has to bleed into the libraries and into the facilities, the organizations, everywhere. So it is open to everybody, but we have a focus on education.
So in other words, you're breaking down the silos, not just between educators, but between educators and the community.
Yes, you have to look at the whole picture and you have to have everybody involved. If you don't have everybody involved, then you're missing pieces. And it just makes everything stronger, the foundation stronger, the connections. And overall, what we're trying to do is help the student, and we're helping the student. So that's what it comes down to. I mean, we're working with educators, we're working with teachers, but the result is with the student that we want to help. You know, when they come in, they need to make that connection to be confident, to be successful in schools and in education. So that's really the goal.
One of the things that I thought was very special years ago is I had a chance to watch Selena Everson work with elementary age children. Of course, she was an elder and has since passed on, but the engagement with the children was almost magical. And I almost felt in that moment that, wow, wouldn't it be wonderful if every child could have access to an elder? And so I have to ask, because you are bringing elders into this conference, are you doing something that mainstream education should take a look at, bringing elders into the education equation?
Well, I say absolutely. Lisa mentioned earlier, we're meeting with elders and having sessions with elders specifically and bringing their words in. The theme of the conference is calling on our grandparents' knowledge for future generations, native ways of knowing, learning, and being. And so calling on our grandparents' knowledge is really what we're doing, and what is fueling a lot of this is tapping into their knowledge, their wisdom. Like you said with Selena, there's those connections that you can't reproduce those certain things. It kind of like with the introduction earlier, it's not about yourself. It's about where you came from and who brought you here. And who brought us here is our elders. And that's really who is bringing us forward and helping us to continue this, and their wisdom, their thoughts, and their voices.
Lisa, what do you think about that? Do you think that mainstream education could take a page from this conference and its work with elders?
I think we're hoping to do just that, right? One of the core tenets of culturally responsive education is bridging home and community and schools. You don't operate in exclusion of one another. And the more that we can build that robust wraparound that really lets students' identities be at the foreground and really takes into consideration students' heritage, students' language use, and students' ancestry, is just can be so empowering for the youth that we work with.
Have you seen progress from these conferences? Have you seen tangible evidence that you're headed in the right direction?
I would say yes. I would say there's a lot less resistance and fear. I would say that there are educators willing to build these connections across community resources and really create space for students to share their identities in their classrooms, to bring their cultures in. It's slow and it's steady, and we'll keep going with it.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us today, David Shakely Early, as well as Dr. Lisa Richardson, who is a professor at the University of Alaska Southeast. Good luck with your conference, and thanks for visiting with us today.
Thank you.
Gunashish, gunashish.
Gunashish. Up next, the mysterious role of spores from fungus in the upper atmosphere, how these tiny particles help ice to form.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Great to have you with us today on Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. The University of Alaska Southeast recently received about $250,000 from the National Science Foundation to study how tiny spores of fungus help turn water into ice. Now, of course, before we go any further, we should clear up the pronunciation of the plural form of fungus. Do you say fungi when others say fungi? Apparently, it is a tomato-tomato kind of thing. At least, that's what this pronouncer we found on the internet suggests.
In British English, it is usually pronounced as fungi. You do want to stress on the first syllable, the fun syllable, fungi. In American English, however, it is usually said as fungi. Fungi in American English versus fungi in British English.
Conrad Meister, a chemist at the University of Alaska Southeast, studies the role of these organisms, which are neither plant nor animal. But just to confuse things a little bit more, he has his own pronunciation. He says neither fungi nor fungi, but fungi. And he blames that on his German accent.
I also don't care if I pronounce it fungi or fungi. People get what I'm talking about. It's actually now a perfect story for next time I teach, because I can tell, okay, listen, I always talk to you about fungi, but it turns out they're called fungi.
Fungi. So, how does one get into studying fungi and its impact on forming ice? I mean, how did you come to this subject?
So I'm basically an ice guy, I would say. So like I'm very, very, very much interested in how organisms, and it doesn't have to be a fungi, but all kind of organisms, fish, insects, plants, how they can deal with the cold or better with ice. I originally studied that in fish, and then I had the chance to go to Antarctica a couple of times to study this problem on how does nature deal with ice or the cold, basically. They keep finding bacteria and fungi in the atmosphere as well. And I realized that there's quite a few fungi that also have this capability of nucleating ice pretty well.
So what does the term nucleating mean?
So what it means is that normally what happens is if we cool water, we all learned in high school that below 0 degrees, we should have ice. Right? Then it should be ice. But in reality, that doesn't just happen. And we know this phenomenon. Sometimes if we put water or even other drinks in our freezer, they are supposed to be in a freezer that's below 0 degrees Celsius, but they're still liquid. And what we call this state is called supercooled. And then if you would shake the bottle, for instance, it all of a sudden magically completely crystallizes and forms ice. The reason that we form ice is that we shook the bottle. And so this is basically the starting point to get ice. And that happens though at temperature minus 17, minus 18 degrees Celsius. And now a nucleus is basically a tiny dust particle, a little piece of something inside pure water, which basically ice starts to form. For instance, every snowflake we see always has this little dust particle on it. And now the fungi or the fungi are 10,000 times better at making this ice than all the dust or whatever we know so far. And that's why it is pretty interesting.
So where does the fungi come from that causes the ice particles to form?
They come from the soil. So they live in the soil, and they're not the fungi that we know that they have actually big mushrooms sticking out. They're more like mold fungi. And so what their natural role is that they basically decay wood and other organic matter and then basically feed on the nutritions. And so one idea is that they actually use this ice making, because ice is obviously very sharp, it's very sharp tips. So it can basically break apart organic matter much better. So it can basically, if you think about, you have a little piece of wood, if I can trigger this ice formation and I have ice, this ice will break a plant apart. And that could be used for either getting the nutritions of the plants or of this decaying wood, for instance. Okay, at some point, the fungi has no more food in the neighborhood, let's say. And that's why they start releasing spores to get to other places. And then they release those spores, travel in the atmosphere, and then they get down somewhere else. And in some cases, the spores are still alive, you could say, because they can start a new colony or spreading somewhere else. But I also have to say that I'm not the expert on fungi per se. I'm a chemist or a biochemist, so I'm really the expert on figuring out the tiny molecules that actually do the job. So the chemistry or the biochemistry behind it. So what makes something very good at making ice?
This doesn't seem like it's mainstream research.
Absolutely. And I think personally, that's why I think it's fascinating. And I think that's why it also has so much potential, and why I think the National Science Foundation gave us this money. Because first of all, the problem we're looking at, people looked at from different perspectives. So a lot of people that really just study the atmosphere looked at it, and then people studying fungi would look at it, but there was never really a connection. And so I only got into the topic a bit because I was studying those antifreeze proteins, which have similar properties, but a totally different purpose in the organism. So it was more a coincidence in that sense that some of the tools we have been developing in the lab work pretty well for that. But I also think it is a lot of times very important to not always look at the mainstream questions, but be wondering how does that work. And I think that is especially true for Alaska, where I sometimes feel we always look at our big three or four. So people look at salmon, at the whales, at the bears. But we have so many absolutely fascinating organisms living here. And it might be that you have to dig in the dirt, but those fungi, for instance, and their adaptation to the cold are so interesting. And I personally think there's also a huge potential for them being used in biomedical applications, meaning there could be something that we can build up as the state here as well, too, because we have the organisms and we should also develop the knowledge for that. Yeah, but it's not very mainstream.
So in forming Arctic ice, where is this fungi coming from? Where is it being blown into our state from? Or does it come from within our state, the interior, southeast?
I think this is something which people are actively doing research on as well. And we also will do that. What you basically do is you collect rainwater and you check what's in the rainwater or what's in the snow sample. And I can do DNA identification. I can say, hey, a lot of times we find this fungi or this fungi. But what we also don't know is we don't have the baseline of, hey, what kind of fungi, what kind of soil do we actually have here? People have been doing that. And again, they have done that for sometimes different purposes. But now it's basically, again, bringing different fields together to solve this problem. And I think that's why I love this problem so much as well, because it's very interdisciplinary. And it is a topic where you really have to talk to people from and experts and just communities from different parts. And I think the short answer is we don't know where exactly which fungi comes from, because we also don't know how far they can travel in the atmosphere. Because if you think about it, it's very hard to track a tiny spore particle coming from somewhere. But I think what the first indication shows is that they can actually travel much longer and much further than we initially expected. And maybe one last side note here is that obviously, this change in environment and also part of the Earth getting warmer, this also has huge implication on this type of research, because the soil is getting warmer, for instance, in the higher Arctic. And that means there's more microbial activity. So there's more bacteria and there's more fungi that can all of a sudden reproduce, or maybe that just thawed. And they can have a totally different effect again on the clouds and maybe change some of the precipitation patterns. So it means it can all of a sudden rain more or snow more. And I think that's also something which we've been seeing. It's getting warmer, but it's also getting wetter. So get more rain. And I think it's very important for us to also start getting those baselines so that we know what changes. And I think this is also one of the reasons why we were luckily able to get this money from NSF and do this research.
People are very worried about ice formation in the Arctic for a number of reasons. If you have enough ice, it can prevent storms from coming in and eroding the earth. And we have a lot of coastal communities that are just on the edge of being swallowed up into the ocean pending any major storm. So do you think that there's a possibility that with warming, that there's fewer spores or more spores that help the ice form? Is there any connection?
I think there will be more spores and more bacteria. The problem is just, so it starts as snow, but if the temperature is too warm, it's still going to melt and it comes down as rain. And then if it rains, it has the opposite effect, because that will speed up the melting of the ice in a way. And so that will have a less positive effect, let's put it this way. But one thing that's kind of interesting is that I was describing that those fungi, or also the bacteria, they are so good at making ice that people actually have been using them, for instance, for artificial snow making, mostly for ski slopes. So in this case, it's mostly bacteria they use, but they basically use them as to let it snow. And there's also been attempts here in the Arctic where they use them to when we build those ice roads or some of the structures where we're depending on the sea ice, that you basically add some of those very active bacteria to the ice, to the water zone, to make it freeze, so to speed up this process. And obviously that is again more like we try to find a solution for a problem instead of fixing the problem. But there's a good chance that this biological solution for some of the issues that we created as a society might be very helpful. But again, we are still in some of the baby steps, I would say.
How do you go about studying this? I mean, what is the type of field research that happens to figure out the connection between fungi and forming ice?
I have a lot of students working with me, and it usually starts that we go out and we collect soil and we let everything in the soil grow. And we see, hey, okay, there's quite a lot of the soil. So you see a lot of white patches and you see bacterial patches. And then we basically harvest those tiny patches, put them on another cultivating plate. And then basically we have quite a bit of the fungi grown or of the bacterial colony that we have. And then we basically just scrap everything up, solve it in water, shake it all up, basically take a grinder and mix it all up. And then we do what's called a freezing droplet assay. So we then have basically a plate where we put 500 droplets of tiny water or solution. And then we cool this plate and we can basically then automatically count. So we have a software that counts it and tells us at what temperature does how many droplets of water freeze. And then we know as a control, we just do pure water. And let's say pure water always freezes at minus 20. And then we see, hey, when we have this unknown sample from out the road in Juneau, it always freezes as minus 5. And it's like, okay, this is very interesting. I always say then the adventure starts, because then we know, okay, this sample has something. And then we use something that's called ice affinity purification. And so there we actually use this trick that the fungi, so they can make ice. So that means they are able to interact with ice. And now we use this, because normally nothing is in the ice. We know ice is very clean. If you go to the glacier, there's usually not much in it, because that means that all of the molecules are being expelled from the ice. So they basically kick them out. But those special proteins that the fungi have, they can bind to the ice. So we basically use a method where we let the proteins bind to the ice, and then we have them frozen in the ice. We can melt the ice, and then we have the pure proteins. And then we start investigating them further with bioanalytical methods to check, okay, what are some of the properties of those molecules.
So where does this research take place? Here in Juneau?
Yes. The research takes place here, except for some of the, I would say, very fancy methods or machines that we don't have at the University of Alaska Southeast, that we sometimes send the samples to collaboration partners. And being from Europe, I have quite a few connections still to Europe, but also I work a lot with people in at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. And this research that's now funded is also with Baylor University in Texas. So the thing is, in order to solve a complex problem like this, you need people from all over the world and also from with different expertise. And we can't just all do it here. But that's very important. The majority of all the work is being done here in Juneau and with all our US students here, which I think is very, very exciting.
So what are the key questions that you're hoping your research will answer?
I think the main question for this research is, how do they do that? How is this tiny fungi capable of creating ice at such a high temperature, where all the materials that we've been making or designing or engineers designed are several degrees worse than that? And so the main question is, I want to figure out how that works and what we say chemical groups. So what are the tiniest atoms, like how are they arranged to make this happen so that we can start copying them? That's one big question. And then the other big questions I have, and that's more personal, I want to know, why do they do that? And then the third question I have is then, okay, can we really use this knowledge to somehow tackle some of the biggest problems we are facing? And that's the warming Earth. And can we somehow help by creating or more ice to those fungi? Can we somehow prevent some of the glacier melting? Or can we somehow slow some of this stuff down? But that's more, I think, questions that come at a later stage, because we first have to figure out how it works.
So it sounds like this project not only will have scientific ramifications, but might train a new generation of scientists?
Oh, absolutely. So we have at least 6, 7, 8 undergraduate research positions in the lab now. So if anyone is interested in fungi research or in this ice witch, they should just contact me and we'll figure something out. And one big aspect of this proposal is also because it's a collaborative work. So that means we do part of the work here, but there's another university in Texas and Baylor involved. And Baylor University is, of course, a much, much larger university with different capabilities. They have a huge medical school. And so the idea is also that we will create a bit of an exchange so that some of the grad students visit Alaska and we send a few students to Texas so that we expand the knowledge of our students and that they can bring back and basically use that as seeds to develop as new scientists from Alaska and that they can also tackle the problems here.
Well, it's all fascinating to think that so much is happening at the microscopic level that we don't even think about that might be useful to us someday.
Yeah, and that's also the part of the fascination or the curse, because whenever you open a door and you start looking closer, you learn so much more and you realize how little you know, which is nice, but can also be very frustrating.
The more you know, the less you know. That seems to be one of the lessons of life. Well, good luck with your research. It sounds exciting.
Oh, I'm very excited about it, obviously. That's why I do it.
That was Conrad Meister from the University of Alaska Southeast. He heads up research into how spores from fungi help ice to form. One of the hopes, to find applications to preserve products like food or medicine by using the spores to keep their temperature down. We never seem to run out of feathered friends in Juneau. Up next, the Juneau Audubon Society's Birds of the Week. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon. Time for our weekly armchair birdwatching visit with the Juneau Audubon Society when Brenda Wright picks three birds each week to spotlight, and she joins us now. Hello, Brenda.
Hi, Rhonda. Nice to hear you again.
Good as well. And I'm so curious. I know you're always out and about and wonder where you've been lately to go birdwatching.
You know, one of the most interesting things of right now is because we have such an excellent run at the hatchery, you can get up close and personal with half the eagles in Juneau. And it's really fun to see all the antics, the little battles between adults and juveniles, and this is mine, and they raise their wing way high to just so that you can't possibly get close to anything underneath their foot, what they're trying to eat. And it's just it's an ongoing show because there's so many fish at the hatchery right now.
And probably a good chance to get some photographs, you think, up close?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. The eagles don't care at all what we're doing there. They're focusing totally on the fish.
Well, that's a good tip to remember. Let's talk about our birds of the week. We have three chosen, and interestingly enough, we start with a seagull.
Yep. This particular gull, the glaucous wing gull, lives here year-round. And it's actually one of the largest populations that lives here year round. It's often the two most populous birds that we have at the winter bird count is this gull, glaucous wing gull, and the mallards. So there must be food here for them all winter, or they wouldn't be so numerous.
So why do they get called glaucous winged?
That's a really interesting question. There's a glaucous gull that's almost totally white. There's no other marking except the yellow bill with a little red mark on it. But the glaucous wing, it's a white body, but the wing is actually kind of gray, not a bit of black on it, or there's no shading on the wing or the tail. And so as you see it go by, it looks quite white.
So you have a song, I guess, if you call it that, from this seagull, the glaucous wing seagull. So let's listen. So this pretty much sounds like what you'd expect a seagull to sound like.
Yep. There's not a lot of melodious sounds that they make, but they're really good at saying, I'm here. Where are you? You should come this way. Let's go that way. Or get out of my space. You're not in the right place.
So the next bird that you've chosen is the willow ptarmigan. And I'm going to play a little bit of sound that you provided for this bird. Now, to me, this really sounds like a chicken in a chicken coop. So why did you select this bird for us to check out?
Well, you know, we really should. It's the state bird for Alaska. The willow ptarmigan was chosen in 1955 by school children to become our territorial bird, and then they kept it as we became a state.
So this bird changes color from white to brown and back and forth. So where is the ptarmigan now in its color scheme?
Well, this time of year, it better be in its camouflage brown shades, because there's not very many snow patches up there above treeline in the alpine where they live. In the wintertime, it's absolutely important for them to be white so that they can hide from predators, or else they would stand out very, very distinctly on the snow. They have a really interesting way of digging down into the snow and roosting overnight. And so you could be walking near them in the wintertime, not even suspecting anything, and they'd burst out of the snow under your feet. You'd topple over backwards.
So our last bird of the week, the horned grebe. That's an interesting name, grebe.
Yep, it's a family of ducks, and they're not the kind like gulls or anything. They never hang in huge groups, but in the winter here, they often seem to be in family groups of 2 to 5.
So this one has kind of a cranky sort of call. So let's listen. So what personality goes with that sound?
Well, I think it's pretty distinctive, and so everybody's going to know that they're where their territory is. They are quite showy in the summertime with that nice gold around their head and eye.
So speaking of showy birds, what are you hoping will show itself this weekend?
Well, you know, it is getting to be one of the times of the year where the birds that have been singing and explaining where their territory is to us has gotten much quieter, because most of them are feeding their young. But in the evening times, you can still hear a pretty nice sweet lullaby of a few thrushes and other birds singing as it gets dark. But soon, very soon, there's going to be a wave of migrants passing from the north south, and it'll get a little bit noisier again then.
All right. Well, we'll be watching for a new wave of migrant birds coming through. Thanks very much, Brenda Wright with the Juno Audubon Society.
Thank you, Rhonda.
Support for Juno Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klinkit & Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.
A quick goodbye. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. Thank you.